Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming live from London. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. Now, there is general agreement in France that President Macron took a huge gamble that was unlikely to pay off when he called a snap parliamentary election. We now have some exit polls to help us see if it indeed went wrong for him. And so far, Marine Le Pen, National Rally on the right, 34%. The left-wing coalition, 28%. And Macron's Ensemble centrist bloc, 20-21%, which led Marine Le Pen to announce her party's victory and a defeat for President Macron.
La démocratie a parlé.
Democracy has spoken, and the voters have placed the National Rally and its allies in the lead and virtually erased the presidential bloc. The French people have therefore clearly expressed their wish to start afresh after 7 years of contemptuous and corrosive power.
And looking ahead to the next round of voting in a week, she made it clear she wants her party's candidate, Jordan Bardella, to be in a position to lead the next French government.
In a democracy, nothing is more normal or healthier than political change. To bring about this political change and start the reforms which this country needs, we need an absolute majority so that in 8 days, Jordan Bardella can be appointed Prime Minister by President Macron.
Well, there we are. Let's speak to the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris, first of all, because we've just heard from Marine Le Pen there. And I guess the next question is, what did Macron say? His Prime Minister's just been speaking as well, I see, on the TV monitors just like 3 or 4 minutes ago. So what are the centrists saying?
Well, I missed that, I'll just then, but what Macron, I'm sure he'll have said exactly what his master, Emmanuel Macron, has said, which is basically... vote to keep out the RN. I mean, there is another vote in a week from now. It's not over. That's the message. Get back out there and to voters on the left or the centre who feel strongly about the RN. Come together to keep them out. Macron said that there should be a large rassemblement, rallying of people. Not even explicitly say vote to keep them out, but that was the message. And that's what always happens in elections in France. Between the two rounds, you get calls from the centre and the left to keep out the far right. That's always happened. It's always worked, but it's not. I just don't think it's going to work this time. I mean, the lead is so great. The disappearance of the shame attached to voting for the RN is complete. People are going to vote for it again massively next week, and all that's at stake really is whether it gets a complete outright majority or whether its majority is relative, and therefore we have an even worse problem, arguably, which is total paralysis in the National Assembly.
Okay, but I mean, if Macron's supporters do, if some of his candidates pull out and his supporters vote tactically with the left, and the left are saying they'll pull some of their candidates out, if they do really coalesce, surely it'll be difficult for Marine Le Pen to push 34% to 50%.
Well, it's in each constituency that this is played out. It's not a national proportional calculation. Look, you're right. You think about it. It seems possible that the left and the centre could come together, and if all good, sensible people did what they were told, then they would, in each constituency, come together and keep out the far right. But it's just not going to be like that. That'll work up to a point, but what the psychologists seem to say is that when a party gets about 35%, and that's where the RN is now, then that kind of blocking opposition vote just doesn't work. So, there is a lot to playful, because the majority can be kept down if the opposition to the RN gets its act together, but there's no guarantee of it. These consignes, as they call them, to calls to voters to follow the party line, they're not necessarily followed anymore.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you very much. That was the BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. And to get more analysis on this, I'm joined by, in the studio, Philippe Malière. He is Professor of French and European Politics at the University College London. And tell us then, do you agree with that this is a massive vote? It's 34%. She's really at the point now where she can push through to government.
Good evening. Yes, it's a very strong showing for the National Rally. I think 34% compared to the last general election a couple of years ago, where the party secured 17% of the share of the vote. So doubling.
She's doubled.
So that's really impressive. Yep. And with 34% as the journalist was explaining just a moment ago, I think it is enough to get a majority in the second round, you know, because each constituency, and there are 577 in all across France, you have to be to come first in that second round. So it will depend on the situation locally. It will depend whether you will have duels or you will have three-way contest.
Okay, can I stop you there and explain that? Because this is going to be crucial over the next week, isn't it? So. Yeah, there are some candidates who've done so badly this time that they'll be dropped out. Under 12%, isn't it?
12.5% exactly of registered voters. That's the rule. So if you secure at least that, you can run in the second ballot.
So in some of those seats, you'll have two candidates, and in some of those seats, you'll have three candidates.
Yes. And it seems that this time round, there could be multiple cases of a three-way contest. Mm-hmm. So, of course, if you have a three-way contest and the whole objective is to defeat the far right, and where you have electorates from different parties trying to coalesce, I think if you have three-way contest, of course, you split the anti-RN vote. So it is hoped that the candidate coming third will pull out in order, you know, to call for, you know, the second place candidate to call for a vote for the second place candidate.
But this is what I was wondering. If President Macron says to a candidate in, I don't know, some sort of distant seat in rural France, and he says to his candidate, I want you to pull out. You came third. I want to give the Left Alliance the chance to beat Marine Le Pen. Does he have the authority to say, just stand down and they obey or not?
He can say that, but they do not necessarily obey. That's okay. The problem. You know, locally, someone can resist the sort of president's statement or whatever party leader's statement and stay put because what they think they might win. But I think it will be very hard to defeat the far right, which is very high in every constituency almost, and will be able, I suppose, to participate in the second run in almost all constituencies, which is absolutely unheard of. It would be very, very hard to defeat the far right if you have lots of three-way contests. So really the key is that. And that's why tonight we are, all of us, listening very carefully the words coming from Emmanuel Macron, from his prime minister, Gabriel Attal, from the leaders of the left, to listen carefully what they say. What kind of withdrawal are they talking about? Is it just withdrawing, or is it under certain conditions? And there are different scenarios.
Well, let's get a take from Mr. Macron's party now, President Macron's party now, because we've got Christopher Weisberg, who is a member of Macron's Ensemble, and he's in the unusual position of representing the French people living in North America in the last parliament. It's a peculiarity of the French system that the Parliament has members of the Assembly representing people in the diaspora. So, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You have your result, I presume. How did you get on?
Yeah. So, we're first in the first round, very closely second by the party of the left. And we, I think, have a good chance to win this election next week.
Right, but that's not representative of what's happened across France. And, first of all, just your reaction to the result.
Well, tonight there is one very likely scenario that is a threat for our republic, is that the party of Marine Le Pen takes power next week with a majority and a clear majority for her party. And this is what I think should be our only concern, is how we do everything that we can to avoid this terrible scenario.
Will you now acknowledge on behalf of your leader that he made a mistake calling this election?
Well, I'm going to tell you, I was flabbergasted by this decision of President Macron about 3 weeks ago. Now it's done. I think it was a political mistake. He tried to clarify positions of different parties, but in a way that was so difficult for any clear majority to win that it gave a real advantage to the extreme right. So, yeah, I feel tonight what's at stake is more important than just what happened a few weeks ago, and we need to build up together a coalition to avoid the tragedy of the extreme right in power for the first time in France since the Second World War.
And do you believe the next week will produce the kind of change you're hoping for in the position of some of the candidates in some of the constituencies, that they will cooperate against Marine Le Pen?
Well, I think there's a path for this, and the first speakers from different parties, the president said something really clear that we had to avoid the Front National. The different leaders of the left also say the same thing. So I think that there is a consensus that we can try to avoid that by, in a way, ask some of the candidates to withdraw from the second round. So a candidate from the Democratic shield, I would call that, is able to win against the Rassemblement National.
Yeah, you can ask them, but are they going to do it?
I think so. Okay. You know, everyone knows what's at stake. I was debating about 20 minutes ago with someone from La France Insoumise, who's probably the most radical left that we have. And both of us were pretty clear that we don't agree on many things, but we agree that we have to avoid the Rassemblement National. So I think this is possible, and this is what's likely to happen, and I'll do everything I can do to avoid that by asking my colleagues to withdraw in difficult and tough races.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Christopher Weisberg there. Congratulations on your results. Still with me in the studio, Philippe Malliere. Now then, just reaction to what you heard from a Macronista.
Well, I think this incumbent MP for Macron's party is very clear on the absolute need to pull out, you know, whenever candidates of his own party come third in support of, I suppose, a left-wing candidate. Not everyone speaks so clearly in his own party, I should say. For instance, I heard Edouard Philippe, former prime minister at the beginning of Macron's first term as president, who said, yes, we should pull out when a left-wing candidate is better placed, unless it is the About France candidate, which is just the more radical left party, which is part of this coalition. So that was already a sort of downplaying a little bit the conditions, or in fact setting conditions, new conditions, and sort of. So there will be different cases depending on what kind of candidate you find in each constituency, with their profile, where do they come from, which party.
Yep, thanks very much. Now, you're with us for the whole hour, so thank you for the moment, and we'll be coming back to you. We've got much more on this later on in the programme. You're listening to NewsHour on the BBC. And coming up a little later, 4 years after the Indian government banned TikTok, what effect has that had on the social media landscape?
There are some homegrown platforms like ShareChat. ShareChat has almost 80 million users. YouTube Shorts got a huge boost in popularity because YouTube is an easy-to-use application. It's international and pretty much have the same features.
Some headlines. The far-right National Rally Party is projected to have taken the most votes in the French parliamentary election, but leaders of the left and centre have called for France to unite against Marine Le Pen in the second round next Sunday. There's been a delay to the announcement of the new South African coalition cabinet, and the UN has held direct talks with the Taliban on the future of Afghanistan. We'll be just discussing that a little later on and asking if that really amounts, those talks, to recognition. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, the people of St Vincent and the Grenadines are bracing themselves for Hurricane Beryl. It's the first of this year, and it comes earlier in the year than normal. Ralph Gonsalves is the Prime Minister of St Vincent and the Grenadines. In fact, he's been in that post since 2001. So, first of all, when is he expecting this hurricane to hit?
Sometime mid-morning, tomorrow, Monday, the 1st of July. It's coming from the south, past Barbados, and then into the Grenadine Islands, which are part of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And it's continuing on that path, the small islands in the Grenadines, and then on to St. Vincent itself. the hurricane force winds will hit us by mid-morning. So we're making all the preparations.
Okay, well, what do the preparations for that look like? Do you move people or do you just build barricades? What are you doing?
Well, we have shelters all across the country. We are opening the shelters this evening at 6 p.m. And we have district committees. We have a good national emergency management organization. I've had a meeting with them. I'm the chairman of that body. And we put all systems in place. We have emergency plans for those whose houses may not be able to withstand winds 115, 120 and upwards, because it's a category 4. It will go to 130 and gust higher. We have shelters across the country. We have food supplies and water, put security systems in place. We should be able to ride it out, God willing.
What happens if some people refuse to go in the shelters? I guess that quite often happens in many places. Do you have that issue?
We don't have that issue so much. It's just to get them to be there on time. You may have some latecomers. I just want them to get on time. I've given instructions that I don't want anybody on the streets after 7 p.m. this evening, so that we brace ourselves overnight for what is going to happen in the morning, and people make all their preparations. And I say, of course, the shelters would be open at 6 o'clock. But those have to go. And everybody has his own family emergency plan. We have a good system, not perfect, but it has been honed through many disasters. And of course, in 2021, we had the volcanic eruptions and we had to evacuate 1/5 of the population into shelters. Of course, preparing for a volcanic eruptions is different in many respects to that of a hurricane, but there's some similar modalities. We are beginning to prepare for what's going to happen after Monday. The seas are very warm. Global warming is not only on the earth, on the landmass, but on the seas. And that's facilitating, engendering hurricanes and storms of greater intensity and frequency.
I was wondering about that because you've been in power a long time, and I guess you've seen a lot of changes in this area over the years.
Absolutely. I've been in office for 23 years. I've seen many disasters and I've seen how things have changed. And of course, the issue of the climate change has become a global issue. Unfortunately, the major emitters are not taking it as seriously as they should. A lot of talk in it, but not a lot of action. But right now, what I'm concerned about is to have people patient and calm, and we are organized and we put in our systems in place to protect lives and limbs. Very often, they do not pay as much attention as they should to these disasters until it's pretty late.
And that was Ralph Gonsalves, the Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines. The BBC has seen and heard evidence that Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank carried injured Palestinian men on the bonnet of a military jeep at least 3 times during an operation in Jenin earlier this month. Now, this follows a video that emerged last week showing one of the men, Mujahid Abadi Balas, being driven on the front of a car, and that sparked international concern. But as Lucy Williamson reports from Jenin, the BBC has now spoken to 2 more people who say the same thing happened to them.
On a winding village road outside Jenin, an Israeli military jeep drives past waiting Palestinian ambulances. Stretched out on its bonnet, a Palestinian man, one arm clinging to the vehicle, the other lying motionless across his body, with what appears to be a large bloodstain near the shoulder. The figure on the bonnet was 23-year-old Mujahid Abadi Balas, shot during an Israeli operation last weekend. More than a week on, Mujahid is lying in a hospital bed. The gunshot wounds to his leg and shoulder framed with external metal fixtures. Burns on his back from the hot metal of the military jeep.
They were beating me on the injury in my leg and shoulder. They were checking where my injuries were and beating me there.
He shows me another video in which a group of soldiers appear to pick him up and throw him onto the vehicle.
What was it like?
I was saying my final prayers. I was expecting to die.
Mujahid's story caused international outrage, but it's not the only one. In the hospital, we also met Samir Dabaya. Shot in the back during the same military raid. And he says, carried to an army vehicle, stripped of his trousers and thrown onto the bonnet. A few brief seconds of footage from a nearby security camera appear to show him, half naked, on the same army jeep. Both men say they were shot around a house in the Jabriyat area of Jenin as Israeli forces came to arrest a wanted man. The walls there still marked by sniper fire.
This is where the jeep came.
At the house, a third man, Hesham Islet, a large bandage on his leg, shows me the olive grove, where he says he too was shot and then forced onto the hot metal bonnet of the same military vehicle.
These tracks here, I guess, yeah.
I tried to put my hand on the jeep. I couldn't. It was burning hot. But they forced me, saying that I should get on it if I didn't want to die.
All three men were later released by Israeli forces. The army said Mujahid's case violated orders and procedures and would be investigated, and that the new allegations we put to them were under review. Jenin has been a target for Israeli raids since the 7th of October Hamas attacks. Since then, Israeli forces have killed more than 120 Palestinians there, civilians and fighters. But armed men still patrol Jenin camp, where the armed groups are based, and residents in the town say there's no sign of the battle subsiding.
What the Israeli army doesn't know is the resistance is an idea planted in the heart. It will not stop. If one Palestinian gets killed, five more will replace him.
During an Israeli operation this week, bombs buried deep in the roads hit troops as they drove in, killing one soldier and wounding 16 others. This battle began long before the Gaza war, but tactics here on both sides are shifting in its wake, and the behaviour of Israeli troops is under scrutiny here too. This is different territory to Gaza, but it's the same adversaries, the same war.
And reporting from Jenin on the West Bank, that was Lucy Williamson. Four years ago today, India banned TikTok. It was one of the first countries to take action against the social media app, which is owned by the Chinese company ByteDance. And India said it was concerned about data security. Now, others, including the United States, are considering doing the same. What might happen if they did? Well, Davina Gupta has been looking at what the effect of the ban was in India.
In early 2020, India was TikTok's largest foreign market with 200 million users. It had quickly become a hit with people like Sumit Jain in the western Indian state of Maharashtra, who grew a following of 4 million.
I own a clothes shop. My friends told me we can share videos on TikTok to show our talent.
Mithali Nikore, founder and chief economist at Nikore Associates, a youth-led think tank in New Delhi, says TikTok's combination of video and music, as well as its ease of use, helped its rapid growth in India.
The algorithms on TikTok also just make things much easier to find, and they don't necessarily favor only the established users, but also new users. And the ability to add songs, etc., in a country like India, that makes a lot of difference, because then you can have, you know, Bollywood-related content which people can prepare on their own.
But growing tensions between India and China led Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government to raise concerns about Chinese-owned apps that held large amounts of data about their users, like TikTok. Then on June 29th, 2020...
As tensions along the border mount, the Indian government has cracked down on Chinese apps.
The Indian government has decided to ban 59 Chinese apps, including the very popular TikTok.
If you've not been living under a rock by now, you know that the government of India has announced the ban of 59 Chinese applications in the country.
But economist Nikore says once TikTok was gone, users quickly found other platforms.
There are some homegrown platforms like ShareChat. ShareChat has almost 80 million users. It does have a good market share. YouTube Shorts got a huge boost in popularity because YouTube is an easy-to-use application. It's international and pretty much have the same features.
Nikore says it's difficult to quantify the economic impact of banning TikTok and the other 58 Chinese-owned apps. But she doesn't think India-based apps have been the biggest winners from the change.
When TikTok was present, it's not as though those same users were not present on Instagram or YouTube. You know, they were still there. They were just there on different multiple platforms. I would say that the space that a lot of these platforms used to hold was taken by a lot of American platforms.
Nikore says it's not impossible that TikTok and other apps could return to India if they address the government's concerns. But 4 years after the ban, the question is whether the users would return to them.
Davina Gupta there on attempts to regulate social media, with the conclusion, I think, that if you block one app, then people just go to another one. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. Back to the French elections now, which, as we've been saying, look very good for Marine Le Pen's national rally. They got the most votes with around 34%. And Rob Young, BBC's Rob Young, is in Marine Le Pen's constituency, Hénin-Beaumont. So, I spoke to him a few minutes ago. What's her personal result and what's the mood like there?
In the moments before the first projections of the results were announced, the champagne was already flowing at this national rally party here. Hundreds of people had champagne flutes in their hands. They were already very much enjoying themselves. And when the projections were put on the giant screens here from one of the main French television channels, the place just erupted into cheering. People were jumping in the air. They were hugging each other. It really was a party atmosphere here. And then Marine Le Pen came onto the stage here. She addressed the adoring crowd. She said that she had won her constituency in the first round. It's being reported she's got 58% of the vote in the first round. That is the first time she has not had to go into a runoff, if confirmed. I managed to grab a word with one of her supporters here. He's a 24-year-old. He's been an activist for the national rally. He's called Constantin Gontelet.
It's a very great result in the first round. It's an astonishing result, an historic result for our political family. And we are very proud and very happy of this result. And we are looking forward to have a majority in a week.
Although a majority of French voters did not vote for the national rally, you got just over a third. How do you see your party getting to a majority in the National Assembly?
Yes, but one of third French people voted for us is a very important result. It's an historical result. And we have a lot of reserve of voices with the Republican right, and all the people against the union of the far left and all the opponents of the President Macron.
What do you say to those French people who voted for other parties because they fear a national rally government?
I say that they don't have to be afraid. We are a Republican party, we are a normal, legal party, and we say to all French, no matter their background, if you are French, if you are truly a patriot, if you love your country, if you respect the law, you have no afraid at all to have Jordan Bardella in as Prime Minister.
Tell me though, what do you say to a voter from the centre grounds who voted for President Emmanuel Macron, for example, or somebody who voted for one of the other parties? How do you persuade them to vote for the national rally when they hear your policies on immigration, for example, or on Islam, and are very worried?
In the second term, we have a very clear choice. You have the coalition of the far left, which more open our borders. coalition wants to make a lot of fiscal measures, increasing the taxes against the people who work. We are working. We have the other part, the National Rally. It's a party of the legality, of the reason, economically reasonable, and we want to protect our borders and not to choice of the chaos.
Constantin Gontelet there speaking to you, Rob, about this very good result for Marine Le Pen's National Rally. Now, there is already an indication that the Left Coalition and Macron are talking about cooperating to try and basically frustrate a Le Pen victory in the second round. What are you expecting? I mean, it looks like it's 34% this time. Do you expect her vote to go up much if there is a coalition against her?
So I think what we heard from Marine Le Pen in her speech to supporters, but she was very much aware because of the dozens of TV cameras at the back of the hall here that this was being watched by people far beyond this community centre in this small town in northeast France. She was trying to reach out, I think, beyond the hardcore supporters and those who have perhaps been flirting with the National Rally in this election because of their frustration with the state of public services or the squeeze on their living standards. And she said, we need an absolute majority. She's asking people to trust her. And as you heard in that interview I did there with that 24-year-old activist, they are very much trying to say people do not need to be scared of this party. They're saying that it has changed. The problem when you go out and speak to people, even in this very town that Marine Le Pen represents, there is concern, there is a fear among some people that the National Rally may have changed their policies. They may talk in a different way, but their concern is that the party hasn't really reformed, and that is why it's going to be a struggle, perhaps, for the National Rally to persuade sufficient number of French people to give them, maybe lend them, their vote in a week's time.
Yeah, because she's been sort of trying to detoxify the brand for decades, really, isn't she? And you're saying in this week ahead now, she'll be tacking to the centre even more.
The language may well change, certainly. I tried to grab a word with her. She was leaving the hall to put this very point here. How will you persuade people who voted for mainstream political parties in France, which have been largely crushed in this election, to vote for her? She didn't want to answer the point. But this is something that the party will be grappling with, and they haven't got very long because the second round is next Sunday.
And that was the BBC's Rob Young, and still with me, Philippe Marlier, the Professor of French and European Politics at University College London. First of all, you've been working your phone admirably hard. I've seen you taking notes on what's happening. What's the sort of latest?
Well, there are slight variations because, of course, we've been discussing exit polls so far. I think the actual results will be known later this evening. I think the National Rally tends to have lost a little bit now in the latest projections, 33.5%, still, very high, very strong showing. New Popular Front, the United Left, is on 28.1%, so still a 5-point gap, which is quite big. Macron's party is definitely the party which lost tonight. There is no victor yet, but it lost on 20%. Republicans, it has to be noticed, on 10% have done better. Centre-right, Sarkozy's party, Chirac's party have done better than expected. They were in the polls on 6-7%.
Let me just ask you, who knows what happens in the next week, and we've been discussing it and speculating, but if Le Pen prevails and is able to form a government, what would it do?
If they are able, I think an absolute majority is within reach for the National Rally. If that broad coalition doesn't coalesce, and it's a possibility, of course. So let's assume they win it with an absolute majority. I think Bardella will be invited by Macron to form the government, and they will implement their policies because they have a majority to back sort of legislation in the House. I don't think we should spend too much concentrating on the economic platform of the National Rally. I think I would expect them to do more or less the same as Macron. For instance, they tend to sound, in some respect, quite leftist on socioeconomic issues. For instance, pension reform, a very controversial reform passed by Macron. They say that they would put it back to 60, retirement age to 60, but now I understand Bardella has given up on the idea. The left would do it. Purchasing power, they talk about that, but in fact it's not by taxing the wealthy, but by bringing VAT down. So I don't think there would be much difference. The difference would be an attempt to redefine Frenchness or French identity. And I think they have a series of measures, which I was struck by this activist in Nambomo saying, we are a normal party. On that, they're not normal. And they remain very much a party on the fringe and on the far right, therefore. For instance, the ban on the wearing hijab in the public space, very strongly anti-immigration, but also an attempt to ban a dual nationality, or at least access to certain jobs for people who have dual nationality. National preference is another policy which would discriminate against foreigners.
And just very quickly, if all those things are done, you know, a whole range of policy areas, Macron can't stop them, right? Even though he's president.
No, he can't, because according to the constitution, it is the government which sort of leads, the policy and implement policy. It's not the president. Yeah. So they would have the last say on that, yes.
Okay, let's just consider what this means for Europe more generally, because there's a European dimension to this. This is a national election result today. But, Marine Le Pen has been a Eurosceptic. She used to talk about getting France out of the European Union. You don't hear that now, but she's certainly part of a trend in Europe where right-wing parties who want more national sovereignty, less European integration, are doing very well. And just to get a take on that, we've got Dr. Marta Lorimer now, lecturer in politics at Cardiff University. And what do you think will be the impact at the European Union level?
At the European Union level, this is not going to be particularly good news or well received. The big issue with the European Union is that the European Union is pretty much a consensus system, and things there work because people agree to let them work. And the National Rally is unlikely to be particularly keen on integrating further. At the beginning, this is not going to necessarily be too much of a problem, because as far as the European Council specifically is concerned, it will still be Emmanuel Macron dealing with other EU leaders. But within the Council of the European Union, it will likely be National Rally ministers negotiating with other member states. And that is probably going to slow down the pace of EU integration.
Yeah, because there's another dimension to that, isn't there? Which is, we just heard on domestic policy, the government gets its way. But on foreign policy, they fight. I mean, that's what happens when there's, a president or a prime minister of different parties in France.
Exactly. And unfortunately for the president only has so much control over what happens. And this is going to be particularly hard, once again, for Macron, because he will be a weakened leader in the European Council, so he doesn't have a majority at home, which means that other leaders might be less minded to follow him if he proposes something.
Can you just give us a European perspective on the rise of the right across the continent? Because it's happening, right?
It is happening, but it's not something that is particularly new. The rise of the far right has been going on at this point for over 30 years. What has really, really changed is that if 30 years ago, a far-right party in government was looked at as something that was extremely unacceptable because their ideas were still viewed as beyond the pale, that is no longer the case. The presence of these parties in European countries has very much been normalized, and we are now seeing them in government in several places. So Italy is the most striking example at the moment, where we have a government coalition that has not one but two far-right parties in it.
Okay, thanks very much. That was Dr. Marta Lorimer there from Cardiff, and Philippe Malier is still with me. I mean, we've got these rightist parties winning, but actually, Europe carries on so far, doesn't it? I mean, it hasn't made a huge difference to what the European Union has done to date.
No, because essentially there's still a majority of parties which are sort of willing to pursue integration, broadly speaking. So I think the far-right parties or hard-right parties are still in minority despite making some gains. But I think if, again, we assuming that there is a far-right government leading France, and France, of course, being one of the founding members of the EU, an important country, of course, that would make a difference. And I think the room for manoeuvre, Macron's room for manoeuvre and power would be greatly diminished. He would even have to go to attend some summits with Bardella. So I think, and he wouldn't be able, he would have to compromise.
We'll come back. Philippe Malier, thank you. The Afghan Taliban government is attending UN-led talks in Qatar, with the UN insisting that does not amount to implicit recognition. It's just that there are things to talk about, things like the economy and drugs. Well, the BBC's Carrie Davis is in Qatar for these talks. And on this recognition issue, first of all, I asked her who does actually recognise the Taliban as the legitimate government of Afghanistan.
At the moment, no country recognises that Afghanistan is ruled by the Taliban. That is not official recognition. That has not happened yet. However, there is a little bit of grey area with certain countries. So Beijing, for instance, has accepted or seems to acknowledge that there is a Taliban sort of near ambassador that is operating in Beijing, and equally has a high commission inside Kabul that is essentially viewed as if it's a diplomatic mission as well. So there's sort of some areas in some countries that are kind of getting closer to that recognition. But in terms of the world at the moment, there is no international recognition yet for the Taliban.
Right. So are the Taliban seeing this as, you know, a bit of a breakthrough in those terms, that it is the world talking to them?
Well, the UN are very adamant that this is not about recognition. They've said that again and again in the build-up to these particular talks. And if you speak to quite a few people here about it, they've said the whole point of these talks is to start the process that could lead in the direction of eventually getting recognition. But this is very much talks that could lead to more talks, that could lead to more talks, that could eventually at some stage down the line lead to some form of recognition. And I really feel that that is being kind of held over the Taliban as some form of carrot to encourage them to keep on coming to these talks, along with other things. As you mentioned, the kind of key discussion points that are happening here are going to be about the anti-narcotics and also about the private sector. There has been controversy around these particular talks. The Taliban, it's the first time they're going to be here meeting en masse with the international community. They were invited to talks here back in February, but didn't attend because at that point they would have had to attend the meeting with representatives from civil society. They have said that they don't want to be in the room with those representatives from civil society. And this time round, the UN has said that they accept that. That means that there will not be women in the room from Afghanistan representing Afghanistan's point of view and side. And that has been a real point of controversy for human rights groups. And we know that various members of civil society groups have actually decided not to attend some other meetings that will be happening on Tuesday afterwards, because they are so angry about the fact that the UN have agreed to these terms.
And that was the BBC's Carrie Davis. Well, Fawzia Koofi is a politician and women's rights activist who was actually the first woman vice president of the Afghan parliament. And she was also chair of its Women Affairs and Human Rights Commission. So what's her take on what's happened, which is basically the UN going along with the idea that in these talks with the Afghan Taliban government, there'll be no women?
Not only woman, no woman is invited in the table, but also the severe human rights violation of our century that's happening in Afghanistan is being ignored. Just to listen to the Taliban, what is frightening, over the past 5 years, there has been concession after concessions, not only from the UN side, but from the international community, in their reckless engagement with Taliban, which has actually led to Taliban being more emboldened and the people of Afghanistan being sidelined, especially the women. Taliban do not see any need to listen to international pressure or listen to the women and people of Afghanistan, because they think no matter what they do, the world is obliged to work with them. Now, what we don't understand is, what is it that the world is so obliged? Is it the regional conflict, geopolitical conflict? Is it the economic interests of different countries that actually make them to listen only to Taliban?
The answer to that is pretty clear, isn't it? The Taliban won the war.
I don't think so. I don't think they won the war. I think Afghanistan was given to the Taliban. The Taliban fought for 20 years. And in 20 years, they were not able to control one district for more than 24 hours. But only after the deal was signed, and I was part of the negotiation with the hope that we will be able to bring a government that is accepted by all, including the Taliban, and including the women, and including the critical voices. But after they signed the deal with Americans, they were empowered morally so much that our troops were demoralized and they managed to get to Kabul. I don't think they managed to get to Kabul because they won the war.
Well, yes, but I mean, let's face it, the West spent billions of dollars. It lost a lot of lives trying to fight the Taliban, and it didn't succeed.
Well, yes, and that's why we thought fight and war is not the only solution. And that's why we went to negotiation. Not only the West invested blood and treasure, but us, also the people of Afghanistan, invested blood and treasure. But the way out of all of this was not the way the withdrawal happened. It was not the way to empower one side of the war and demoralize and marginalize the other side of the war. If there was a war and the war had a party, I think the government of Afghanistan, well, I was a political opposition, and you know that. But as a matter of principle, the government of Afghanistan should have been engaged from day one when these negotiations happened, which did not. So that resulted to the total profound collapse of our government and failure from the international community as well as the Afghan politician. But we are in a new chapter. And again, the UN and international community is repeating the same mistakes. So our call was that the UN should actually respect the same independent assessment report produced by their special envoy, the UN Charter, and do not only listen to the Taliban, listen to all sides. And that's how you form a political process.
And there we are, unhappy, very unhappy with the UN. That was Fawzia Koofi. Now, just finally, before we go, we're going to go back to France, because it is a very big result, this. And we've got a tape now of the French Prime Minister Attal talking about the result, urging people to coalesce, basically, against Marine Le Pen. Here's what he said.
La leçon de ce soir.
Tonight's lesson is that the far right is at the gates of power, and so our objective is clear, to prevent the National Rally from gaining an absolute majority in the second round, and therefore from governing the country with its disastrous project. Not a single vote must go to the National Rally.
Okay, that was the reaction in line with what Macron said, as you'd expect. And still with me, Philippe Marlier, who is at London University, made the journey across the channel to teach students here. And one thing we haven't really discussed is, we've talked about if Le Pen wins an absolute majority and forms the government. What happens if she's just short? Which must be quite a possibility.
Yes, that will be a hung parliament. And I think in that case, Jordan Bardella might even refuse to take the job.
Her candidate as a
Yes, because he won't have any majority to pass any legislation. So there will be political blockage. And I think it would be in a bit of an awkward position for him. So he might refuse. He said it already, that without an absolute majority, he will not govern. He will not accept the job. So there will be a next scenario, which will be a kind of national unity coalition with, supported by MPs from Macron's party, from Republicans, and from the moderates on the left. That would be another possible scenario. But will they reach this absolute majority of 289 seats? That remains to be seen.
Yeah, and just the last point, that there can't be another parliamentary vote for a year. So they'll have to sort something out.
That's right. According to the constitution, Macron has to wait 1 year now before dissolving again, should he want to.
Thank you so much. And that was Philippe Malière. And that's it for this edition of NewsHour. So thanks very much for listening. And from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.